I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Do universities have hidden value to cities? We know about their role as employer, as purchaser of local goods and services, as producer of smart people, as source of research. But our guests today are mining their value more deeply and coming up with some surprising results. Bob Milburn is president of the Columbus Partnership. Columbus, Ohio is home to more than 100,000 college students, and still, the city suffers a brain drain. Bob hopes to change that, and we'll find out how on today's Smart City. Also with us is Rob Hollister, dean of a unique program at Tufts University to turn students into citizens. That's today on Smart City, but first the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Bob Milburn is president of the Columbus Partnership, a civic improvement group of Central Ohio business and community leaders, to develop a long-term vision for the Columbus metropolitan area. Prior to that, Bob led the Greater Milwaukee Committee. Bob, what is the most important thing to know about Columbus, Ohio?
Well, I'm not sure there's one thing, but Columbus, Ohio is the 15th largest city in America. Very few people are aware of that. We've got this sort of identity crisis going on here. It's a big city, largest city in Ohio. It has these incredible assets that every city in America would love to have. It's a state capital, has a very large research university in Ohio State. And it has a large number of Fortune 500 companies headquartered here, and most of them are in industries that are growing. There's very little manufacturing in Columbus. It's mainly financial services, business services, retail, collection of companies like the Limited and Cardinal Health, which is the largest company in Ohio, headquartered here, Nationwide Insurance, companies like that. So it has that rare combination of a strong business community, a state capital, and a major university. One of the things that we're learning about Columbus that we believe will allow it to propel itself in the future is this very large group of young people, particularly young educated people. We have over 100,000 college students in Columbus when you add up all the institutions. And that places Columbus only second to Boston in the number of enrolled college students on a per capita basis. And that's a pretty wonderful thing to have going for you, particularly in these days where we're all learning that the future of our cities will depend on a young, educated workforce.
What doesn't it have other than an identity?
Well, we don't have mountains and we don't have an ocean. We're right here in the middle of the state of Ohio. So it doesn't have the sort of physical features that, you know, some cities are fortunate to have. But it's got the right ingredients for this city to grow and prosper in the years ahead.
Why do you think Columbus lacks a strong identity?
Well, part of it is just the history of a city that has been slowly growing somewhat faster than other Midwestern cities. So it's in a little bit of the shadow of a Cleveland or Cincinnati, which are two other large cities in Ohio that probably are much better known than Columbus. And it's only been in the last 20, 30 years that Columbus has had this spurt of growth that where it's now a larger city than either Cincinnati or Cleveland. It has this Midwestern value that we commonly talk about. I'm not sure we properly understand it, but it's a city that doesn't really toot its horn or pat itself on the back, and that probably leads to somewhat of a lack of identity that you would like it to have.
Is Ohio a plus or a minus?
Well, in my speeches around town, I've had this habit somewhat humorously to say that if it weren't for the state of Ohio, Columbus would be doing even better.
Ooh. I'm sure your state legislators are not real fond of that.
Well, what I mean is that the economy of Ohio has been you know, hit pretty hard by the whole manufacturing downturn in recent years. And the rest of the state has really had tough economic times. Columbus is sort of the one star within the state where it has continued to grow, and it's a pretty prosperous place. But it would be even better if the whole state of Ohio were growing like Columbus was.
Well, you have this collection of assets that you talked about. You lack an identity. Tell me where Columbus's greatest opportunities lie.
Well, I think our single greatest opportunity probably does lie in this need that every city seems to be fighting for, and that's retaining young, educated workers. We are in a tremendous position to do something about that. When you have 100,000 college kids coming here, the task of trying to hold on to as many of those young, bright people as you can is certainly a lot easier task than trying to bring them here at age 24 or 25 or something like that. So I'd say that the big challenge here is to make sure that Columbus has the kind of job growth, it has the opportunities that will attract these young people to remain in our region rather than migrating someplace else.
Do you think they have a good experience in Columbus? In other words, now that we've learned that college-educated 25 to 34-year-olds are looking first at place, the place they want to live, and then they look for a job, are they having the kind of experience that would make them choose Columbus?
I think increasingly so. I think we still have a distance to travel. One of the things that, of course, young people love to have is a vibrant downtown. And that's been a big focus of all of our efforts here, from the mayor to the business community, even with state government, helping in ways that it can to create a more vibrant downtown so that young people have that vitality that they're all always looking for. And we're making very good progress there, but it's a real challenge for every city, and Columbus is like the others.
You took the city through an extensive process to understand how Columbus can capitalize on its business assets. Describe that process. I think lots of cities are looking for the way to get to the answer for each city. Tell me what you did in Columbus.
Well, we had the good fortune of having kind of a blank slate here in Columbus with business leadership, because we formed a new organization called the Columbus Partnership. That's the group that I work for. And this is the 32 CEOs of the larger employers, people that really can make a significant difference in a community when they start working together and stacking hands. Our group, because it was new, didn't have an agenda, so we had to create one. And obviously, the major interest that business leaders tend to have is in the area of economic development. So we retained the help of Michael Porter, the Harvard Business School professor, who's done a lot of work on competitive advantage. And we went through a very systematic 18-month exercise to try to identify what was the real economic development future of Columbus and our region. We identified the major clusters that we felt where Columbus had a competitive advantage. Those included logistics and distribution. This is a very major distribution center in our country. Automotive, we have a huge Honda plant here in Columbus that is supplied by 170 vendors that are businesses right here in the region. So it's plenty of opportunity for growth in that area. Our third big cluster is all around what we're calling personalized medicine. That's driven mainly by the OSU Medical Center, one of the major medical centers in the country. And then the fourth one is what we're calling tourism and arts and culture, which is really kind of an entertainment cluster that includes our interest in downtown vibrancy, finding ways to keep these college-educated young people in our community. So we've identified these clusters and then have created an organization called Compete Columbus, which is set up to be a strategic economic development organization that will begin to develop a work plan around each of these clusters.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Bob Milbourn. He is president and CEO of the Columbus Partnership. A couple of questions you've raised for me, Bob. One, when you think about a cluster like logistics and distribution or automotive, how do you know what's happening in that cluster today? You can pretty much see the landscape both in Columbus and worldwide. But how do you push out and look 10 years, 15 years, 20 years forward and anticipate what's going to be happening in those industries then and how you push Columbus toward that?
Yeah, let me take you through the kind of logistics and distribution cluster because I think that's the best example. There are several cities in the country that can claim to be a major distribution center. Columbus is one of them. We have a very large cargo airport that very few cities have. It's an old Air Force base that was shut down many years ago. Luckily for Columbus, we've retained it and we've developed it into a cargo distribution center. And we have rail coming to it, we have trucking going to it, and cargo airplanes. And so one of the things that you do to make yourself better in this business and a better location for companies to locate here is that you give people the kind of infrastructure that that industry needs. So we're building this major intermodal facility that will save companies up to a couple of days, and in the distribution business, a couple of days of time saving is a very, very critical thing. So we've invested a lot of money, need to invest more money in making sure that if a distribution company looks at Columbus, they will see a real competitive advantage in locating here. The airport has these two very long runways. We've got two railroads serving the property, obviously good highways and good interstate system that serves the property. So what we believe is that if we give the proper infrastructure for distribution, we will draw the kind of companies that we want to see built here. Our location is fantastic. We're within, a two-hour drive of about 8 million people. If you look at the map of the United States, Columbus is about as well located for logistics and distribution as you can possibly have. Then yet what you need to do is bring the industry together. I think this is a mistake that many cities make. They look at a cluster and they say, oh, well, we have an opportunity to grow this cluster, so all we need to do is think up the various things that ought to be done. And they forget the fact that there are a large group of very expert people in the cluster that they never bother to assemble. Part of our effort here at Compete Columbus is to bring those employers together at the table and allow them to forecast the future because they're much more likely to do it well than a group of consultants or university professors or whatever else you might bring together. So that's what we've done and are doing. And those folks keep telling us, well, here's what you're competing against. There are other cities in the U.S., other cities in the world that are getting good at being a great place to run a logistics company or a distribution firm. By having the employers involved, you end up with a much richer array of action steps that a city can take.
Do you find that competitors, to the extent that people within a cluster compete directly, sometimes obviously there's supplier relationships, but to the extent they compete, are they willing to sit down at the table and think together with you about the future of the industry?
Yeah, I think there's a real yearning for more of that, not less of it. We have found that the distribution companies all are looking for similar things, and therefore they don't view it as sitting down with their competitors as much as they're sitting down to make Columbus stronger for everybody, not just for them.
You also mentioned the strength you have both in retailers and, as you said, to expand at multi-store companies. And you mentioned the Limited and Abercrombie and Wendy's. Why did that happen? How did that happen that Columbus became home to some of America's best-known retailers?
I think they fall into like two categories. First, there is this that unique entrepreneur that happened to be born in Columbus. We have two companies here that are quite large, the Limited, which is headed by Les Wexner, who grew up in Columbus, started a store, and all of a sudden now has 10,000 stores all over the country, and he decided to remain in Columbus for his home. And then the other company, Cardinal Health, which is in the pharmaceutical distribution business, that's an $80 billion a year company. It was formed here about 40 years ago by a young man named Bob Walter, and he also decided to stay in Columbus and grow his company. And so that was, you know, a matter of happenstance. And the other category would be Columbus for many, many years was viewed as this very strong test market. If you wanted to test a product, whether it was in the retail business or fast food, Columbus would tend to be the place that companies would come. And as a result of being this test market, a number of these retail and fast food companies started up here, and we now have a whole bunch of them, Wendy's, White Castle, just a whole series of very interesting companies that are in fast food and now retail as well.
Tell me this. What do you find different about CEOs today and their willingness to engage in community versus 15 years ago?
Well, there are a lot of changes. I've headed the Milwaukee business organization called the Greater Milwaukee Committee, and now here in Columbus. And in the 20 years or so that I've been doing this sort of thing, I've seen an enormous amount of change in the way CEOs can operate within their communities. One constant is that most CEOs do want to engage in the community. They're looking for a way, a vehicle to be involved and do good in their community. It's more difficult for them today than 20 years ago, and that's partly because of the globalization of their businesses. They travel more. They're out of the city a lot more than they were 30 years ago. We have more professional management in our larger corporations. There's been a lot of consolidation, so many businesses are headquartered in one city and therefore more difficult to be as active in a community in some other city. The role of banks in our community, is all of our communities, has changed as consolidation has taken place there. I just think that most CEOs have found it more and more difficult to spend the time working on community efforts, whether it's downtown development or economic development or arts and culture, any of the key areas where you need that kind of help. And so CEO groups like the Columbus Partnership are forming to become sort of the forum for that activity. So they have their own network, their own agenda, their own ability to influence and be catalytic. Their own staff that can actually work at these projects on a day-to-day kind of basis. And there's really no other easy organization that suits the needs of these CEOs of the larger companies. And so groups like the Columbus Partnership form to become that forum.
How much of a city's success do you believe is determined by leadership?
It's a very large share, whether it's political leadership or business leadership. It's a very, very, very big thing. If you have very strong business leaders, things can get done that will take forever without it. And I'd say the same thing is true with a strong mayor. We happen to have a strong mayor in Columbus, and he has been a good leader, and he works well with the business community. And that's obviously the perfect combination. Without those strong leaders, whether in the business community or in government, it is much more difficult to take on, you know, bold action, strong, you know, risky ventures. And some of these big challenges that we face do require taking some risk. And one of the advantages of getting the top business leadership involved is that they see that and they're willing to take it on. Whereas a lot of other people may not.
Do you keep your agenda necessarily and deliberately small?
Yes. We're big believers that you work on projects that have a beginning and an end, And there's only a handful of things that any group can do well at one time. So we have an agenda of really three or four things that we're trying to do. One of them is centered around all this economic development stuff we've been talking about. We've also been focused on education in Columbus, both our public school system, Columbus Public Schools, and higher education, because it's so important here. We've been working a lot on the kind of physical development of the city. That's something that business leaders are quite good at, figuring out how to make your city a stronger place physically, whether it's using the river in your downtown or building buildings that become icons for your city. These are the kinds of projects that business leaders really are good at.
But didn't business leaders in some ways give us the deteriorated downtown or the empty downtown that you said was a detriment to Columbus?
Well, you could look at it that way, or you could say that businesses have been over the years moving to where their customers are. And as we all know, more and more people have found their way to the suburbs over the years, and businesses have followed them. And our highway system has taken people there over the years as well. I do think that there was a period, maybe in the 60s and early 70s, when everybody, including business leaders, kind of forgot about their cities. And I hope that that's reversing itself today, because I think we've all learned that you can't have a strong region if you do not have a strong and healthy downtown or city environment. That's true here in Columbus, and I think true all over the country.
Just one more question, Bob. You said you believe in working on a few projects and projects with a beginning and an end. I'm wondering, where do you see the end of your involvement in education, particularly K-12, which is so confounding? And what role do you think your organization and other business organizations can productively play in improving K-12 education?
Yeah, you're not going to fix urban education in a short period of time.
I was wondering where that end was.
But what you can do is you can take the problems of urban education, which do seem pretty overwhelming, and you can begin to break it down into projects that do have a beginning and an end. So, for example, we work very closely with the superintendent of our public schools, and we're looking for areas where the business community can help improve the quality of our schools, whether it's helping them with a building program, which is going on here in Columbus, or in the charter school movement. We're working with our public schools to look at a possible charter school in Columbus that we have a lot of interest in. We can work with our public schools on problems that they face in budgeting or planning or accountability even. One project going on right now that the partnership is part of is putting our school board through a policy governance exercise.
Well, that's a good idea.
And it's coming along very well, where the school board members and the superintendent begin to understand where that line is between the policy-making role of a school board and the administrative role of a superintendent. Public school I've ever been around in urban America has that problem, and it's the kind of thing that people can learn better ways of dealing with.
Are you working with Broad on that or someone else?
We're working with the Aspen Group.
Oh.
And they've now been in Columbus, and our school board and superintendent are now engaged with them in a consulting arrangement that will hopefully put them into a much better place in dealing with the issues of micromanagement and, mm-hmm. you know, board policy and the role of the superintendent, because it's a very tough job. I happen to believe that being the superintendent of a public school system in any city in America is about the hardest job there is.
I agree with you. Bob, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Enjoyed it.
Bob Milbourne is president of the Columbus Partnership. After a short break, we'll return to talk with Rob Hollister about the education of citizens on today's college campuses. Plus, we'll talk to Otis White about the legacy of leadership. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Chamber Foundation, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis and the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. Otis, at any point in time, a city lives with the legacy of decisions made by leaders who are now long gone. You've written recently about the legacy that Detroit lives with.
Yeah, it's a tragedy. You know, there's so much that's going on in big cities now that is positive, a reversal of bad forces that were at work for year after year. The great exception to this turnaround story seems to be in Detroit. And so it's worth asking the question, so what went wrong with Detroit? Why has it missed the boat? Not just the city of Detroit, but the whole region, the whole southeastern Michigan region. Why has it sort of missed this great urban turnaround boat? And the answer seems to be there are two big problems in Detroit. One of them was a decision made at some point in the past, and it's easy to say it was 1967 when the riots took place, but it probably was before that, in which first the leaders and then the citizens of the region just gave up on the city of Detroit. The middle class fled to the suburbs and not only fled there to live, but in some way closed the door and lost any interest whatsoever in the city. And the result of all of that has been a terrible segregation along race and class lines. There's been an awful lot of bickering back and forth. There's very little dialogue among the political leadership of the region. But maybe even worse, there's a complete lack of cooperation on things that other regions have found lots of reasons to cooperate on, things like regional transit, which they still do not have in any significant way in Detroit. The second big mistake that was made in Detroit was to find some new economy to replace automobile manufacturing. Other cities have made a transition from their traditional economic bases to something else, and Detroit, for all its efforts, has not been able to find that. The result of all this is that with the auto industry in terrible shape, as it is from time to time, economically, the entire region is suffering, not just the city of Detroit, but Macomb County, Oakland County, all the traditional suburbs there. And I don't see any quick way out of this. This has been a long time in the making, and unfortunately the people who live in that region are suffering from tragic decisions that were made many decades ago.
John Seely Brown, the former chief scientist at Xerox, says that competence can create tunnel vision. In other words, if you're really good at something, you fail to see the edges. And it seems to me that Detroit was so very good at automobile manufacturing that it really closed off the possibilities for them to see how things were changing. Although, I have to say, having been in touch with a number of people from Detroit recently, I'm more encouraged about Detroit's future than you are. They have a terrific new online publication, Model D, that is packaging what's going right in the city in a very positive way. There are people looking at the opportunities for inner city development in very imaginative ways, what has been abandoned, what can be done with it. There's a coalition of people there that I think are beginning to think very imaginatively about Detroit's future. Plus, interestingly, Detroit is in the metro area with Ann Arbor, and it actually does better than most cities in the top 50 metro areas on the attraction of young people.
Yeah, I certainly don't want to imply there are no assets whatsoever in the Detroit area. And I personally know Detroit pretty well and have always been a big fan of the city. I just don't see those great forces that are transforming other regions yet having much of a significant impact there. But I'm optimistic. I'm glad to hear there's some good things going on there.
Well, we'll wait and see. Otis, we'll talk to you next week.
Okay, Carol.
Otis is a regular columnist for Governing Magazine. Rob Hollister is Dean of the Tisch College of Citizenship and Public Service at Tufts University. A specialist in nonprofit organizations and public policy, Rob has been engaged in teaching graduate and undergraduate students, practicing professionals, and citizens for more than 30 years. Rob, what motivated the creation of Tisch College of Citizenship and Public Service?
Two major reasons, Carol. One is the just great need for more effective community leadership across the country and on a whole host of issues. And then the second basic reason is large and growing student demand. At Tufts, we get a large number of prospective students for whom community service is an important part of who they are and also part of what they're looking for in college. And so we, in part, established Tisch College in order to respond to those interests and to prepare them for lifetimes of active citizenship.
Are students today simply more community-minded, more community-motivated?
You know, I think they are. Certainly today, as compared to 10 or 12 years ago, there's a big leap in the number who are idealistic, who have significant community service experience. It's interesting, actually. In some ways, there's a persistent popular myth that young people are uninvolved in their communities, not interested in community change. We experience exactly the opposite. The level of student enthusiasm is very high and growing.
You said that one of the reasons for the creation of Tisch College is the need for more community leaders across the board. I couldn't agree with you more. What is it about the student experience in volunteering or in citizen engagement that needs to happen to make them aspire to community leadership throughout their lives?
Well, a big piece of it is reinforcing the values that they already have. Another part is helping them see what the rich array of opportunities are. One of our key working approaches at Tisch College is to take a very broad definition of public service, that it's equally about participating in electoral politics or on a nonprofit board, or to help a future businesswoman integrate civic values and activities in her business career.
Let me ask you, is there anything about the experience of public service while they are college students that you want to ensure they have so that they will think their service has been meaningful?
Yeah, really good question, because just more and better volunteering doesn't accomplish it. What I think the key gleam in our eye really is a set of educational outcomes. And so to help students in the full spectrum of majors, fields of study, and in the full array of future professional walks of life, first of all, understand what the opportunities are for community leadership and that they reach well beyond the by definition public service roles of working for government or being a community organizer, both of which are important, but the opportunities in really all fields of endeavor. And then to, through their volunteering, to have that experience, whether it's working to combat homelessness or to clean up the environment or to combat domestic violence, whatever the issue is, to maximize the extent to which that experience really pays off, not only in terms of the service dimension, the community benefits, the impact on people, on the lives of people being served, but also in terms of the skills that students learn. So, for example, that they get better at analyzing muddy, complicated community issues, and that they gain some experience and confidence in mobilizing people and other resources in order to attack the root causes of those issues. So I think a key opportunity at Tufts and at other institutions of higher education is to make that experiential learning really pay off in terms of the various components of effective leadership.
And do you have to structure that for students? Are students expected to structure that, or are the organizations for which they are volunteering and getting involved supposed to structure that?
That's a great question. In fact, it's all of the above. One of the things that we find is incredibly powerful is supporting student initiative. Some of the most effective learning and serving opportunities are ones that students invent and run themselves, and our role is to stay out of the way or to be coaches, and but basically to let them run with it. We also, both with in the curriculum and in the extracurriculum, do a lot of things that are very direct interventions. And part of what we're doing at Tufts that I think has some uniqueness is working with faculty in all fields to help them embed in their courses this same array of skills training. And I like you're asking me about is there some responsibility also on the part of community agencies and groups that we work with? And the answer there is a hearty yes. There are, I think, wonderful examples that we've encountered of community groups that are very willing to take on a kind of partner role in the educational process in return for what they find to be very concrete, specific service contributions to the mission of their nonprofits.
I'm really interested in the point you make about students really getting excited by and learning from initiatives they create. And it seems that there has been an explosion of nonprofits and social entrepreneurial organizations by bright young college students, college graduates that are tackling some of the toughest problems the country faces. To what do you attribute that?
You know, young people are smart. They have terrific energy. My colleagues and I don't know it all. We have some experience that is helpful, but an 18-year-old who has mobilized her peers in Houston to improve science education in the elementary schools of the city comes to college with some fresh energy and insights that reach beyond what a university professor with exactly the same professional focus can have. And then there's just the extraordinarily powerful dynamic or ability of peers to inspire and organize each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we all, you know, many of us, and certainly college students are no exception, particularly people with especially strong leadership abilities, do their best work when it's something of their own invention and creation.
Are there certain causes that you find have special appeal to students?
There's a particularly strong popularity of work with younger children, child development. I think if there's a single area of emphasis for the students at Tufts, it's efforts to improve K-12 education and to work with young people, including young people who've from poor backgrounds or who are challenged in their educational experience.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Rob Hollister. He is Dean of the Tisch College of Citizenship and Public Service at Tufts. College students are people who have just come out of the K-12 system. What perspective do they bring, Rob, that is different from that of educators and administrators and politicians who run these systems now?
I think they often have an acute sense of what's wrong and what needs improvement. And many of them aren't jaded, aren't daunted by how difficult it is. So they have a very attractive can-do attitude and a sense that in some ways the fact that they don't know in detail what some of the very real obstacles are is an asset.
Don't know the obstacles. What are the obstacles? What stands in the way of students getting involved in public service?
Incredible cross. The time pressures that they're under is a factor for some. For students who have to work at a part-time or full-time job in order to be in school, that's can be a major barrier. In that respect, one of the wonderful facilitating factors of the higher ed civic engagement movement is the federal work-study program, which enables students to do community placement work-study, to do community service and earn some money at the same time. Another obstacle within the university, there are a couple of barriers in many places. One is that the conventional approach that most higher ed institutions have taken to their public service work is to build up a separate center for public service. And there are many of wonderful such centers at schools across the country. The limiting factor is that it can tend to isolate the work or create a separate public service ghetto, send a message, oh, you're a professor of mechanical engineering or you're a student major in the same department. You want to do community work, go over to that separate place across the campus with the sign over the door that says Center for Public Service. And I think you can have far more impact through the full engagement of the institution, which is an infusion model that we're trying at Tufts, which is saying civic education, preparation in the values and skills of active citizenship is everybody's opportunity, whether you're in an English department or sociology or whether you're in preparing to be a pediatrician.
Do you think the same idea, Rob, can work at the high school level? Should high schools be requiring students to do public service work?
Yes, I think the same. I think exactly the same concepts and approaches work at the high school level. And in fact, part of what propels our work is the impressive movement across the U.S. to elevate the scale and the quality of community service activity at the high school level.
Tell me about the media and public service program at Tufts.
This is a program that a wonderful award-winning network TV producer, Roberta Oster-Sachs, developed at Tufts. She came to us and said, look, you all are seeking to make education for active citizenship a hallmark of the university and of all fields of study. Where do media skills, knowledge of the mass media is clearly a key component of being an effective community leader in this democracy. So over the last few years, we've developed a set of courses and internships that focus on media literacy and media skills as a key part of active citizenship. And one element of that that's just been wonderful to watch is a course called Producing TV Shows for Social Change, in which small teams of students, literally over a single semester, these are students without any previous TV production background, as a team produce short social issue documentaries about one that I recall was about a anti-drunk driving initiative, Melanie's Bill in Massachusetts. And at the end of the term, those films are screened to an all-campus audience. It's a very high, it's an occasion for wonderful public dialogue on campus. And the learning impact for those students is just phenomenal.
Now, you've mentioned several times other universities nationally doing this work, but I know you've been looking internationally at universities doing similar work or talking with universities internationally who want to do this work. Tell me about your world tour.
The civic engagement movement's more advanced in the U.S., but there truly is, Carol, a still somewhat invisible international revolution of civic engagement and social responsibility work of universities. The president of Tufts last September convened an historic first gathering of presidents from 29 of them from 23 countries. It confirmed that we're in a period of extraordinary expansion of the higher education civic engagement work. And there are three factors coming together that make this just an incredibly important trend. One is the dramatic increase in the scale of higher education. Today, there are about 100 million university students worldwide. By the year 2030, that number will literally double to 200 million. I mean, imagine the civic power of that group. And if we can multiply several fold the opportunities for those students to both serve their societies and learn leadership skills at the same time, that's an incredible benefit, incredible way of accelerating economic and community development. A second major factor propelling this movement is rapidly growing demands from outside the university system on higher ed institutions, that they jettison the ivory tower model and much more directly contribute to the community development and economic development in China, in India, in Sudan. And then the third piece is that we are beginning to have some very impressive models and examples that prove that this area of work is possible, that it meets multiple goals. So you take those together and it really adds up to a major trend, and I think some exciting opportunities for those universities in different parts of the world that are beginning to work together around their civic engagement work. At the gathering that I mentioned at our European Center in France, the set of presidents launched what we're calling the Talwar Network to foster continuing dialogue and collaboration. They're now at work with our support on developing a common global project which focuses on knitting together their local efforts to expand access to education and to combat illiteracy.
What, in your opinion, is the next stage of university-community partnerships?
Well, one piece is to get clearer about the educational outcomes and to document them and to use that document to reach greater scale. Because by definition, colleges and universities, we're not social service organizations. Our core mission is educational. So to reach the full potential of our civic engagement work, we need to demonstrate that it really meets two standards, both community benefit and higher educational and research outcomes for the college or university. So demonstrating results, documenting is one. Moving toward real partnership. Scale, I think, is another key piece of what I would advocate as a vision for the next stage. And finally, to integrate the service work with the institution's core functions of education and research.
Well, Rob, it seems like what you're describing has great potential both for universities and their students, as well as communities. Thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Thanks for this opportunity.
Rob Hollister is Dean of the Tisch College of Citizenship and Public Service at Tufts. Over 200 years ago, Benjamin Franklin instructed, "Dost thou love life? Then do not squander time, for that's the stuff life is made of." CityView's commentator Walker Smith urges that not every waking minute has to be maximized.
What if we were required to go out and have fun? Would we think of it as a chore? Would we look for ways to get around doing it? Would we invent shortcuts? Would we try to hire someone to do it for us? Would we put it off to the last minute? And once we took care of it, what would we do with our time off? Seems kind of silly, doesn't it? Yet more and more we're squeezing time for fun into whatever time slots are available. which means that once the time for fun has arrived, it's pretty much required that we spend that time having the fun scheduled for that time slot. Is this what we mean by fun? Does the scheduling get in the way of having fun? Time is now the most valuable currency in our lives. Notre Dame law professor Kathleen Cavaney contends that a quote-unquote billable hours mentality has taken over, a view in which time itself has no intrinsic value, only instrumental value measured by accomplishments and profits. While we could always choose not to approach time in this way, Cavaney believes that lifestyle pressures have forced us into this mentality. We can't help but be aware how every minute ticks by, either as money earned or money spurned. John Robinson, an emeritus professor of sociology at the University of Maryland, has been studying how people use time since 1965. Robinson reports that in his 1998 survey, for the first time ever, more people said they were pressed for time than for money. It's ironic that the ways we are squeezing more time into our lives are keeping us from having the times of our lives. We are determined to make sure that every hour earns its keep in order to justify its passing. If it's not on the schedule for making money, it better be on there for having fun. Progressively, and largely imperceptibly, we have lost touch with the texture and character of activities and celebrations that draw upon a different experience of time. As a result, we have begun to rue the loss of a sense of leisure with which to spend our time. Life has become nothing but a calendar crammed over full. One of my favorite things to do for fun is to run, to just get out and release myself for an hour or so. I make a point to avoid clocking myself when I run. I try to enjoy it free from time pressures. I don't pace myself against other runners, and I stop however often I feel like it. If I didn't do these things, then running would just be more of the same old competition and hustle I get at work. And even though I'd still be getting good exercise, I wouldn't be having any fun. Admittedly, this is not much, and it's certainly not the answer to the ways in which calendars run my life. But however slowly this is helping, it's a start at least, and the last thing I want to do is hurry it along. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders speeding innovation in cities. Information at ceosforcities.org. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundation's investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.